Our ability to make choices, to make changes, i.e. call someone instead of texting them or forego the technology for a walk in the park, whatever it is. Start off with your own daily routines. What can you change? What can you do? How can you interact differently with your partner, with your friend, with your neighbor? Otherwise, it's always the same old story, just repeating.
Yeah, but I think the important element here, too, is to do what you just said, yes. Look at what you can do as an individual, but also look at the culture at large. Look at your community and ask yourself, what are the good things in this community? What are the values that make sense for a good life to be lived as a human being?
You are listening to The Sill with Peter Noce and Harry Posner.
Come on in, have a seat.
Join the conversation. Good morning, Harry, and the shattered cultures and simpler times. That's what we're talking about today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Are you feeling shattered?
Actually, I'm feeling fairly composed, but I may feel shattered throughout the podcast.
We're holding our pieces together, just barely. So what we're going to do today is we're going to kind of take a trip down memory lane, but not in order to stroke our nostalgia muscle, but more to kind of ask some questions about those times we lived in as young people, Peter and I. Our formative years were the 50s, 60s, 70s in a way. And so we're going to talk a bit about those times and the times we live in now and kind of compare them, compare and contrast, if you like, the lifestyle that people lived then compared to now, how young people were then compared to now, et cetera, et cetera.
I will preface a little bit as well, because you were actually born here and I wasn't. So I really didn't get into the culture here until probably the early 60s, because I didn't have a TV really until 1961, having come here in 1958, whereas you were born in Toronto. So some of the shows that you were watching in the late 50s, I caught in the early to mid 60s. In any case, we're talking primarily in the 60s, where we did most of our growing up, or at least the awareness of what was going on. So we're spanning 60 years here in this discussion. I think we have a pretty good spread to make the comparison with our experience and what happened during those years.
Okay, because I'm a bit older than you are by a few years, my recollections go back a bit farther in terms of relevance and awareness than the early 60s. I am a child of the 50s, born in 1951. So before the Bay of Pigs, before the Kennedy assassination, my life was in the neighborhood. It was making friends. It was having fun outside our bakery in downtown Toronto. My parents had a bakery, and I would be out front playing with yo-yos, with hula hoops. I'd be roller skating down the rough pavement with roller skates that you tightened around your boots with a key. So I had a very innocent upbringing in that respect. But I do remember, especially my parents' reaction, my mother's reaction, actually, in particular, to the assassination of JFK. And I didn't understand how big an influence he had, because my mother was deeply saddened. There was a depression, and everyone I kind of met in our area in North York, in Toronto, had the same kind of deep, beyond sadness, this deep grief for an American president, of all things. So, yeah, that was my first recollection of kind of world events. And I had no really understanding of the Bay of Pigs and what that was about. The Cold War, it was going at the time. It was maybe the biggest thing happening at the time was the Cold War. And Vietnam, of course, coming into effect as well a bit later. So that's my beginnings, anyway, in that era.
Yeah, and we're basically in the same time zone, because I also recall that Kennedy assassination, even though I had a limited understanding. I remember just the feel everywhere in my home, in the schoolyard, friends, family, everyone seemed to be so struck by that particular moment and that particular man, and things sort of evolved from there. And of course, it almost perfectly coincided with the British invasion, the advent of the flower power generation and all the political unrest. The big change, I would say, and there are many things that we'll discuss here, it was the rapidity and the frequency of information that flowed to us from various news sources. And our ability to even acquire information or knowledge on specific areas, we were far more limited. We grew up in the days of the transistor radio, newspapers, and so on. And TV, of course, even back then, as you recall, there were a few channels on TV, most of them American, and that's where we got our information. And when changes did occur, they were not anywhere near as fast as they are now. So we had sort of time to adapt to these changes. And the other big factor that I recall was that it seemed, whether right or not, or whether they had the right ideas or not, that everybody moved more in sync. Parents, teachers, institutions seemed to be in overall agreement on what to do, how to proceed, and so on, even if it wasn't necessarily ideal or the best, because we could always discuss that as well. But in terms of where we were as a society, we seem to be more on the same page. Would you agree?
I would, but I think you're hitting on several points at the same time here that we need to kind of separate out. So first of all, you talked about the speed at which information reached us, and that's true. I remember, in fact, when JFK was assassinated, I remember Walter Cronkite, the American newscaster, come on, choked up on the air, and gave us the facts of what had happened to JFK. That was about it. You also have some radio reports. Of course, the newspapers would come out with the story and all that. But then that was it. Beyond that, it was talking with your friends and your relatives about, oh my God, what happened? How did this happen? How could this happen? Et cetera, et cetera. But there was no wild conflagration of information flying all around the world instantly, as happens now when these kinds of events unfold. So we had a chance to digest and to kind of talk to each other about it and to ease into the reality of it, in a sense, compared to today when there is no time to do that, to ponder, to meditate on it, to think about it. And our television, which was black and white in the early days, it had a limited run as well. At midnight, I think it was, is when the telecasting shut down. And then this image of an Indian head would come on the screen with this high-pitched boo sound indicating the end of the broadcasting day. And that was it. None of these all-night 500-channel universes. That was it. It was time to go to bed at that point if you're up that late. So, yes, all of that was happening during our period. Everything was just slower. And, oh, yeah, the second part that you mentioned was the integration of attitudes and thoughts. There's sort of a similarity amongst people, not as much divisiveness, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a function of the way culture holds itself together through its stories, through the history of the peoples who settled this country. I'm speaking now primarily after the native population. In this case, the culture that we were born into was that culture. And there was a certain cohesiveness to it because immigration levels were quite low at that point, increased a fair bit after the Second World War. There was a lot of migration after that war, but not as quickly as we've seen in the last 30 years, 40 years, where increased immigration changes the whole dynamic of the cohesiveness of a culture. So now you have different points of view. You have different cultural elements coming in to play with the cultural elements that we grew up with. And the diversity, multiculturalism became the word of the day at a certain point. And that changes the cohesiveness of a culture. Therefore, you're going to see different points of view, more different points of view than we had been exposed to when we were younger.
When we were growing up, the TV was the focal point for individuals and families at the time. That's when people gathered around the TV, much like they did in the 30s with Roosevelt and the radio. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about the limited number of channels and the limited viewing time, as you said, often in the early years anyway, was turned off overnight. It was also that the content that we watched was much more constrained than it is today. There were limitations laid out. There were rules of things that could be said, what could be shown. Mm-hmm. We received a much different picture than we do today. We didn't have the wide open frontiers when it came to what could and couldn't be said and what was diluted or what was censored, for lack of a better term.
Well, every show was a family-friendly show, without exception.
And we could list so many. As I said, I focused on the 60s, but I got the 50s stuff too. So we knew shows like Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, My Three Sons, then later on shows like Bonanza and so on. As you say, they all centered around a family theme and were intended for family viewing. children and parents could sit and watch, laugh, discuss. There was much more unity that way. It wasn't just about the program content. It was also how the content was viewed.
Yeah, and it wasn't about diversity as it so often is now in these shows and films. There's a conscious effort these days to make diversity a part of the culture. So you don't see the kind of homogenous television programs like Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons and Father Knows Best, those little sort of family-friendly, nobody steps out of line too much unless it's a goofy stepping out of line. There's no profanity at all. You couldn't say damn. You couldn't say bitch. You couldn't say hell, even, I believe, in my earlier days. So we got a certain idealistic, I guess, view of family and the world through the television that we watched in those days. It was a bit of a ruse. It wasn't really real at all.
Exactly. I mean, one of the ones that comes to mind, which were among my favorite for both, I believe, the Dick Van Dyke Show and I Love Lucy. Mm-hmm. Where it was imperative to not even suggest that they were sleeping together, despite the fact that they had children. When they showed them in a bedroom, they had to be on separate beds with both their feet on the floor.
Right.
Obviously, they didn't have the creative imagination we had.
Yeah.
As if being in separate beds or having your feet on the floor is going to stop you from having some sort of sexual interlude. In any case, it was, thinking back to me, it was quite humorous. So in that regard, I think, though, when we talked about this prior to actually doing the podcast, that whole idea of which was better, we encountered our own difficulties in those years with the way it was.
Like what?
Well, I don't believe that we received the real picture. I think there was far more, especially in North American culture, there was a lot of censorship going on. Because even in the 50s and 60s, if you explored countries like Sweden, for example, the programming was more open. It was more real to life. Sex was not excluded from things. It was presented perhaps in age-appropriate manner, but it was not excluded. It actually showed things that existed in real life. So I think in that way, at times we were over-sheltered and overprotected. But I understand why, and everybody seemed to be in agreement on it anyway. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken place. But I think it was overly puritanical at times. I thought it was overly strict.
The baby boomers were born between the 1940s and mid-60s. This is my mom's generation. These are the people that perfected smoking. They smoked at home. They smoked at work. They smoked in church. They smoked in restaurants between bites of food. There were ashtrays on the tables at McDonald's. They smoked in the car with their children with the windows rolled up very tightly. But we're all still here. Now, for some reason, the boomers are upset and mad at the millennials. And to be fair, everybody's mad at the millennials. And I think it's because they invented avocado toast. And the word artisanal. And they're putting pumpkin spice in way too many beverages that should not have pumpkin spice in it, right? And it's not their fault. Millennials, it's not your fault that you're big goobers. It's not your fault. It's not. It's because your Star Wars had Jar Jar Binks in it. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And it doesn't matter because the millennials are all getting married and having babies now and their lives are over, so it doesn't even matter at all, so. After the millennials come Gen Z. Gen Z was born between 1995 and 2015. Gen Z, these are my kids. Good luck, America. Gen Z doesn't know how to write a check. They don't know how to address an envelope. They don't know how to read cursive. They don't know how to read a paper map. They can't get anywhere unless there's a GPS map on their phone. All I'm saying is if Gen Z takes over the world, it's going to be pretty easy to get it back. We're just going to write our battle plans in cursive on a piece of paper. And then mail it to ourselves in envelopes.
I think in order to be fair in this comparison of from the good old days to today, we need to really spend a little bit more time sharing with people, especially younger people who may be listening, how our lives unfolded. So let me just go back to school, okay? I'd like to go back to school. And in school, in public school, we were made to sing God Save the Queen and to recite the Lord's Prayer every day before the beginning of classes.
Mm-hmm.
No matter which culture we were born in, which religion we had, our parents followed, we had to do this every morning. And there was actually a level, I remember, a certain level of comfort in that, you know, that there's a ritual that involves singing, that involves a kind of meditation, the Lord's Prayer is a kind of meditation, even though it's Christian-based. And I felt sort of comforted, even though I was Jewish, I felt very comforted by that. And then as immigration continued to accelerate in Canada, in particular here, because that's where I grew up, we found that parents began to be upset that their Muslim children or their Hindu children were kind of coerced into singing God Save the Queen and then speaking about the Lord's Prayer, a Christian prayer. So what happened was, at a certain point, the authorities started to get nervous about this anger from these folks, and they just said, okay, well, we'll just cut out the Lord's Prayer, or we'll make it optional to speak along with the Lord's Prayer or not. And then it became more diluted, and eventually the Lord's Prayer was just taken out of the school system altogether, and God Save the Queen was replaced by the Canadian National Anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So this increased immigration and increased secularization of society, kind of moving along in tandem, really led to this change in education in the early years, which makes a big difference. In general, though, I would say that in our childhood years, Peter, we expected less. We had to wait for the mail. There was no email in those days. We had to wait sometimes weeks for our mail to arrive, or our comic book, or our special doodad from a cereal box offer to arrive. And there were less products out there. There was less immediate gratification available, which tended to make us a bit more patient, and it tended to push us more into intimate relationships. Less emphasis on speed and things, etc., which today we've got a kind of siloing that happens, and people are lost in their cell phones, in their computers, and they're sitting in their closets and in their houses and not actually in cafes talking politics and building relationships. So that's a bit more background on our younger days for people to get a sense of as we talk more about today's life.
And I would add to that the amount of time that we spent outdoors,
yeah,
and the amount of time we interacted with nature, the amount of time that we spent doing things at a certain pace. You built your little race car out of wood and nails.
Yeah.
You spent hours, days, and weeks on it. It was also the joy of doing it. You weren't ever sitting around saying you were bored or that you didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The shattered culture, to me, comes from the absence of a lot of those things that you just described.
Right. So it's the cohesiveness that we felt as we were growing up that began to unravel as secularization happened, as increased immigration happened, and then as technology happened in a big way.
Mm-hmm. The technology, of course, accelerated things. The globalization increased also migration and other factors that are all sort of interconnected. But really, to me, it's not about trying to stop that change, because that change is going to happen. The problem or the challenge is, how do you take the culture now and keep pace with that change? How do you educate? How do you inform people? So, for example, if a person understands that the reason why there are more people of a certain ethnicity, it's because the conditions on the globe have changed. The migration has increased from various areas. Why? Because in part, our desire to increase our standards of living and so forth have created also differences politically, economically around the world, where we've gone to other countries. We've used them for our manufacturing, for the production of things that we ourselves want. And so therefore, we have had a part in creating a lot of this new society. And yet we want to remain in our little pockets, and we don't want to be in any way destabilized from what we had, while still wanting all the things that are now being manufactured elsewhere or being created elsewhere and brought into the country.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want certain cultures or you don't want to experience certain changes, then work within your own system so that that doesn't happen.
Right. And the one thing that you mentioned, that change thing, you keep coming back to these changes that we have to adjust to. And I would like to move the clock back again, because these changes didn't just fall on us out of nowhere. These changes were pushing at us at certain times in our development in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and onward, where television was introduced in the 40s, 50s, computerization a bit later on, 60s, 70s. You have computerization coming in. You have increased immigration coming in. But all of those changes were subject to human beings saying yes to them. We're subject to human beings deciding whether to put regulations and put the brakes on any of those changes. And because that didn't happen, we are left with a world that we have to somehow adjust to, rather than adjusting the world to our needs, to our human needs, to our community needs. Now we have to adjust to these quote-unquote changes you mentioned. And so, yes, we are there and we have to adjust now because we didn't actually meditate and take the time and think about the repercussions of allowing these things to evolve in our society at the pace they did.
Wealth disparity. It's off the charts now relative to what it was even 50, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. So you're serving a smaller and smaller percentage of the population and trying to impose the system on the entire population, but it's really serving fewer and fewer people. When we were growing up, even in only this single generation that we're talking about here, there was more equilibrium in terms of the top end and the low end. We had a very distinct middle class. Mm-hmm. The working man could afford all the basics, yep, if not the luxuries. Yep. And now we've put so much in the hands of so few that the equilibrium is completely off. And we try to muddle our way through and try to explain things, and we don't realize that we are victims of our own greed and excess.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. Economics played a big, big role in that shift in economics and in the balance between the middle class, upper classes, lower classes, the class system, and how that shifted is profoundly affecting how we live now and our attitudes towards politics and economics, etc. But it is what it is, as you said. This is today's world. And so the question is, is today's world, in a sense, better than our childhood world, do you think, Peter? Or is it, would you say, worse? Can you compare in that sense? Can you say, for the human condition, for the human being, is life a better place to be now than it was back when we grew up?
Fundamentally, I think we have a much better world than we had in terms of reducing certain discomforts, availability of things that weren't available. Practically speaking, I think we have a better world, but I see the weakness in we didn't develop the spiritual or understand the importance of gratitude and the community when we made these transitions. We created this fast-moving, economically based, better standard of living focus and not understanding the price that we would pay or are paying for that, mm-hmm, which is increased isolation, which is the loss, in my estimation, of a lot of critical thinking that I think is very important to the function of a healthy society. We lost, to me, the most basic things, which are respect for the elderly, respect for families, the importance of mothers to society, who not only bring children into this world, but are primarily responsible, even in the modern world, for the raising of children. And I think that that's where we are today. The human problems haven't really changed. The caring, the respect, the community, technology and speed and all that has not changed those things. And so we're constantly striving, we're constantly looking. It's like this empty vessel that can't be filled. And no amount of self-help books and no amount of all these things that we do will fill that very void, which is based on an absence of the things that human beings function well with.
Okay, so think about it this way. In nature, if you introduce into an ecosystem that has been around for a long time a different element, a new plant, a new species of wolf or something or animal. That can often either be the end of the ecosystem because it's too disruptive altogether, or the ecosystem gradually adjusts to the new entries into its landscape. So it's the same with human culture. We have allowed into our culture heavy doses of technology, heavy doses of corporate economics, heavy doses of sectarian type attitudes towards how we educate our kids, and et cetera, et cetera. So these changes that we have accepted into our ecosystem, our human ecosystem, have repercussions. And you've just elucidated some of those repercussions. Less compassionate. We're less compassionate as human beings. We're less thoughtful, as you said. Our critical thinking is really poor. We're very divisive now. We're very prone to conflict rather than working it out among fellow human beings because of all of these changes that we have accepted willy-nilly. So from my point of view, we can actually try to save some of the good things from those days and bring them back into vogue, if you like, reintroduce them in small and subtle ways into our school system, into the general societal intercourse, to work on relationships, to put away our cell phones for hours at a time, to close the lid on the computer, go outside to be in touch with nature, to call a friend. Don't text, call a friend. You could do that. Some people are ditching their advanced cell phones for very basic flip phones that just do phone calls and the odd text or something and no other applications. So people are choosing, some, to simplify their lives. And in a sense, it's like going back to those days. Although we can't, as you say, completely turn the clock back because we're in a new space now, a new environment, and we have to learn how to live with it.
I think we do things in reverse. We're looking for our leadership to change things. We need to change first. The compassion that you speak of, the caring that you speak of, our ability to make choices, to make changes, i.e. call someone instead of texting them or forego the technology for a walk in the park, whatever it is. Start off with your own daily routines. What can you change? What can you do? How can you interact differently with your partner, with your friend, with your neighbor? Otherwise, it's always the same old story, just repeating.
Yeah, but I think the important element here, too, is to do what you just said. Yes, look at what you can do as an individual, but also look at the culture at large. Look at your community and ask yourself, what are the good things in this community? What are the values that make sense for a good life to be lived as a human being? And try to inculcate those in your children, in your friends, or what have you, in your circles, and do it that way as well. And that way, as we move on through time, capital T time, we'll hopefully be able to carry with us some of those good things and not just have them be lost in the shuffle and the speed of all of the stuff that is coming at us so quickly. That's what I would recommend anyway, we think about doing more of.
Yes, and to simplify it even further, if you can't do or think of anything else or can't get to the point where you can make some significant changes, just adopt the thinking of what positive thing can I see in any situation that I'm in. From a community point of view, as you described, if I'm in a community situation with other people, different languages, different cultures, different ways of thinking, when I encounter something that I have difficulty with or is challenging me, instead of looking at the negative aspect of it, what's the positive side of it? What's good here? Is it all bad, or is the fact that we're even just talking about this a move in the right direction?
Yeah. And there's also no excuse in our modern world that we can so easily disrespect. There's no excuse for not knowing what's going on in the world. When we were children, when we were young, we could be, in some respects, innocent of that and not even aware of it because there wasn't as much information flowing at us as there is now. But now, there is no excuse for not knowing what's going on in the Ukraine, for not knowing what's going on in Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, that's a good thing. People need to be informed about their world, not just their local community, but the world at large. And so the modern age we live in, of course, helps to make that a possibility, which we didn't experience when we were younger. So there are some good things about living in this time period. It isn't all bad, for sure.
Yes, and a certain level of patience and tolerance, because look, despite millennia Every society seems to have the same basic problem, regardless of the changes in technology, regardless of the increased standard of living. We live in a world where poverty is at an all-time low. We have every convenience known to man, and we're still dealing with the same problems. And what are those problems? Problems of living through your childhood, problems of still dealing with things that were inculcated into you when you were not even talking or thinking for yourself. It's the same basic things. And I think sometimes culturally, even we try to explain things away, or we pay people untold amounts of money to self-help groups, and we attend conferences. We're just searching for very basic things that are either emanating from traumatic experiences or from a lack of connection.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And as we get older, as we have, Peter, you and I, we tend to look back more and more with rose-colored glasses at those early days, at the halcyon days of childhood when you could be innocent of all of these things. But we are adjusting, and to our credit, to our generation's credit, we have adjusted fairly well to these changes, I think. So let's sing together, Peter. Let's sing our way out of this. Let's sing, how about we sing, "Those were the days, my friend, we thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. Da 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 da. Those were the days, oh yes, those were the days." Thank you very much.
You've cornered the vocals, Harry. I'm just backing you up in support. So on that note, as always, enjoyable, and ciao.
Ciao, Peter. Be good.
You too. The Sill is a Connecting Dots Media production, available at thesillpodcast.com.
Thank you for your donation to The Sill Podcast.